From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has been arbitrarily detained by Sweden and the United Kingdom since his arrest in London on 7 December 2010 as a result of the legal action taken against him by both governments.
That was Christophe Pichot, spokesperson for the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention, looking at the claim of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange that he has been suffering arbitrary detention. Pichot spoke at a press briefing on the group's decision early Friday. The UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention ruled Friday that Assange has been held arbitrarily in the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
The expert panel called on the Swedish and British authorities to end Mr. Assange's deprivation of liberty. I think the recommendation is quite clear. Respect his physical integrity and freedom of movement, and afford him the right to compensation. Mr. Assange, detained first in prison, then under house arrest, took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London in 2012 after losing his appeal to the UK Supreme Court against extradition to Sweden, where a judicial investigation was initiated against him in connection with allegations of sexual misconduct. He was not formally charged. The Working Group on Arbitrary Detention considered that the various forms of deprivation of liberty to which Mr. Assange has been subjected to constitute a form of arbitrary detention.
For the past 3 years, Assange has lived in the embassy where he took refuge in order to avoid extradition to Sweden on allegations of sexual offenses and, he said, fears of being extradited to the United States for the release of U.S. documents. Ecuador granted asylum to Assange. The UK government issued a statement Friday saying it would arrest the WikiLeaks founder regardless of the UN group's findings. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange participated in a news conference from the Ecuadorian embassy in London via video link that followed the decision on his case by the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention that was released Friday morning. A panel member announced that Assange's 3-year detention in London was illegal.
While being detained now, without charge, in this country, the United Kingdom, for 5.5 years. That's 5.5 years where I've had great difficulty seeing my family and seeing my children. Today, that detention, without charge, has been found by the highest organization in the United Nations that has the jurisdiction for considering the rights of detained persons to be unlawful. I consider the outcome in this case to be vindication. The United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention is the world expert body in understanding the law of when someone is to be detained or not detained. Let me repeat them here. The United Nations last night stated that the working group's decisions are legally binding. You'll hear more from Balthazar Garzon as to the level of its decisions. They are an opinion juris, which is higher in the hierarchy of international norms than domestic law, than treaties between countries. So they are part of the founding basis of the United Nations, which the UK and Sweden are part of. Now, I have read this morning the comments of UK Foreign Minister Philip Hammond insulting the United Nations, calling a decision which I doubt very much that he's read, ridiculous. I find those comments to be beneath the stature that a foreign minister should express in this situation. This is a serious finding. It adds to a already very important body of international law. And while I understand the momentary political imperatives for representatives of Sweden and the UK to look like they're correct in their earlier ardent lawful decisions, the fact is that they are not. There has been a final decision. There is no ability to appeal the decision of the United Nations. The lawfulness of my detention or otherwise is now a matter of settled law. The United Kingdom and Sweden had their opportunity to appeal. The last 2 weeks they have had that opportunity. They did not lodge an appeal. They cannot now seek to object to the findings of a process which they themselves were involved in for 16 months. A jurisdiction which they submitted to, recognized, and in part founded together with their early involvement in the United Nations. You can't decide that you are going to recognize a forum, take place in proceedings, respond to the other party, and then at the end, when you don't like the outcome because you have been breaking the law and you don't even bother to appeal, come out with press statements and say, well, we disagree, or engage in purely superfluous ad hominem attacks, like saying that a finding is ridiculous. Those statements are simply for domestic consumption. They have no relevancy in terms of law. It is the end of the road for the legal arguments that have been presented to date by Sweden and the UK. Put simply, those arguments lost. There is no appeal. The time for appeal is over. No appeal was lodged. So I want to turn a little bit to where things go from here. It is now the task of the states of Sweden and the United Kingdom as a whole to implement the verdict. Now, why there can be attempts for the media, for the popular press, to look tough and attempt to undermine that, a serious attempt, not just for show, would have the effect of undermining the UN system. And there are consequences of doing that. And Sweden and the UK know full well that there are consequences. Those consequences include not merely weakening a human rights and international law instrument to which both countries have signed binding treaties, but rather it will have the diplomatic effect, and diplomats know it. The diplomatic effect will be to make life difficult for Sweden and the United Kingdom to be treated seriously as an international player, as international players that obey the international legal obligations. Their attempts, if they proceed, to undermine the UN system, we'll see various enforcement measures that can be taken by the UN. Those initially, of course, can include the removal from UN committees, the movement against those states in various voting processes, and ultimately up to and including sanctions. Now, that's, of course, a matter for the UN to decide about how it's going to enforce its decision, and a matter for Sweden and the UK to think, do they really want to go down that path? But we have now a complete and decided law on this case. This is a very interesting case. Let's just everyone go and read the result of the UN working group. WikiLeaks has tweeted it. You can also look on Justice for Assange. That's in the background here. And finally, I would like to thank the UN for considering over the last 16 months our submissions and those of various states, and producing this verdict, which adds not just to my freedom and to justice for my children, but it adds, I think, significantly to the ability of the UN to deal with complex cases of arbitrary detention, including those involving Western states. Now, this victory came about not just because of the situation I'm in, but because of a lot of hard work. So with that, I would like to say thank you. I miss my family. We have today a really significant victory that has brought a smile to my face.
Last week saw the passing of a man who was the epitome of the local activist with a global perspective. Sundiata Sadiq was a lifelong activist for black liberation, for socialism, and for international peace and solidarity. He passed on Thursday, January 28th, at his home in Ossining, New York, the Hudson River Village among the northern suburbs of New York City that is also home to the infamous Sing Sing prison. Sadiq was an activist his whole life. He was a key figure in the fight for political prisoners, some internationally known, like Mumia Abu-Jamal and Leonard Peltier, and many lesser known. He was also well known among anti-war organizing circles for decades, going back to at least the time of the Vietnam War, when he was known as Walter Brooks. He had previously been a U.S. Army paratrooper. Among his notable national achievements, a lawsuit he helped craft in 1973, the first environmental racism suit in the history of the NAACP. After lengthy negotiations with the NAACP's national board and in conjunction with environmental attorney Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Austin chapter of the NAACP, which Sadiq led, brought the suit seeking to stop the expansion of a waste transfer station owned by local former police officers located in the village's black community. Sadiq's fusing of the local to the global met with much resistance from the NAACP's national leadership and ultimately to the revocation of the Austin chapter's charter by state official Hazel Dukes. In the New York Times, July 17, 2005 edition, it reported that, quote, in Ms. Dukes' view, there are enough serious problems in Austin to keep the local branch busy, closed quote. Duke was incensed when Sadiq and colleague Charles Coca, who followed him as chapter president, compelled the NAACP's national board at its annual meeting to adopt a resolution calling for a new trial for imprisoned journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. They forced the board's hand by organizing a massive street protest outside the meeting hall after the board initially refused to act. A year after suspending the Austin chapter, Dukes was in the village facing Sadiq and the community. Sadiq opened the community's presentation with the following.
Our NAACP was basically controlled by elements of the Democratic Party. When certain people raised issues about million-dollar housing going down on the river and we wanted certain environmental improvements, it was within the NAACP that many of these people were run out. Some of these people are here today and came back because they saw that there was a new thing taking place. In terms of police brutality, I mean, there was a young brother shot and killed here. The police said that they shot him while he was standing with a gun, and they shot him four times. Well, the undertaker was Baker. He called my house And I saw the pictures of Chris Malone. He was shot in the back twice and threw his face and taken out his tongue through his neck on a downward shot. Most people told me he was laid on the ground. But there was a demonstration by the NAACP, but there wasn't any follow through with what really happened to this brother. What I'm saying is that political parties have controlled this organization in terms of where it was going, whether they're going to deal with the environment, whether they're going to deal with housing. There are people here, when we were deactivated, we went from house to house to apartment to let people know that Section 8, their Section 8 was going to be taken away from them. They didn't believe us. I mean, they're sitting here now. We went from door to door. We put out leaflets. The Latino sister here helped us with, became part of the NAACP. So we had people doing the work. And I agree with you, they wasn't turning in the report. I mean, we would report all the time what we were doing. So I want to just say one thing about, I know there was something about the Mumia Abu-Jamal resolution that we did in 2004. Arsenic. New York State killed 645 people in the electric chair since 1889. 615 of those people were killed right here. They were murdered in Austin, including the Rosenbergs, whose son I know and work with. We believe that they were murdered. Now, we had a youth group going into the prison back in the 70s where Steve Hawkins, the lawyer for the NAACP legal defense, came out of the Harvard. Now he's an eminent lawyer on the death penalty. And certain things began to happen. So, when we were approached by Pan Africa and the international movement to free Mumia Abu-Jamal, who said that he was innocent, and that we looked at the documents, well, it was only natural for us to support Mumia Abu-Jamal. And our executive board in meetings, one year passed it, I went to Miami Beach and we tried to get the resolution passed and was stopped. And we went to Philadelphia and it was successful. So it's not that we went someplace to, you know, just bring this case to the people, but we have been talking about Mumia Abu-Jamal for a long time. In 1992, I have a newspaper article where we demonstrated right here in Austin with Bobby Hurico, who's Ethel and George Rosenberg's son. We marched around the prison and we talked about Mumia and other prisoners that were located right down in Austin, Africa. So we are a prison town. This is a racist town.
Pam Africa is a co-chair of the Free Mumia Coalition, with which Sadiq was deeply involved. We spoke with her via Skype from Philadelphia Friday. Pam, welcome. A pleasure to speak with you as always. And we lost somebody.
Yes, you know, we lost that body, but the spirit of Sadiq and the seeds he had planted from the youth and the examples that he set will forever flourish. I know a lot of youth and elders and all, you know, who got more involved in the work around Mumia because of the work that he has done and the example he has set and all to the very day of his so-called death. I've seen Sadiq, and if it wasn't for Brother Sadiq and the determination that he had to put Mumia, you know, on the front line of the NAACP, and that's where it wound up. It wound up in their books, you know, in their magazines, and, you know, I've seen him help organize, you know, massive demonstrations, you know, around Mumia. When we met with, you know, I have pictures of him when he went to, it was in California where they were having the Democratic convention, and in Florida. And he confronted John Street, the mayor of, you know, Philadelphia at that time. And, you know, we had pictures with him with Julian Bond pushing and all for, you know, Mumia. And he went as far as going to Washington, going to Harrisburg, wherever it need be. And then, you know, what I loved about him and, you know, he couldn't get in to visit Mumia because his name wasn't on the list. And but when Alambe Breath wanted to go to visit Mumia, he drove us up there. And, you know, he had to, you know, pick them up in New York, come, you know, and Philadelphia, and he picked me up, him and Suzanne Ross, and then we went up to visit Mumia. And he was on the outside the whole time because his name wasn't on the list. So I'm saying he wasn't about being, you know, right up there up front. And I don't think he ever got to visit Mumia. He was more about doing the work.
Right.
And 'cause this is the kind of person, you know, that he was. And I'm saying Mumia and our life and our is, you know, lives today because of people like Brother Sadiq, an example that they set of one, because people said, oh, you know, you'll never get a resolution, you know, out of the NAACP. Well, we got it in Philadelphia, and that's where the most fear is at, and it was a part of his leadership. And then on the 100th centennial, people said, oh, big business and, you know, things like that, you'll never, you know, get a resolution out of that. Well, we did, and because of his determination and the people, those of us who worked along with him. And when he was terminated from the NAACP illegally by Hazel Dukes, it didn't stop him. He was Brother Sadiq NAACP in exile, and and going into the prisons and visiting people, and you know, he was instrumental in the case of Russell Maroon Schultz. And when we went up, when I let Sister Amina Baraka know of his death, she was devastated, and we were going up the following day to his janaza, and she said, pick her up. And you know, and there's a lot of people who learned about it at a late time, and I'm quite sure there's going to be a memorial, and I want to be one of those members in organizing or whatever part I can play in, you know, letting those who did not know. And I thank you to the utmost, for having, you know, this interview with myself and others about who this brother is, you know, he'll be sadly missed, but when I talk about Sadiq, there's never anything sad about it. And, you know, even his going to that next level, because that's, you know, something that all of us have to do. But what he left on this level here, and, you know, when you talk about him, you feel good. And, you know I do. I don't feel a sadness at all. And, you know, very humbled and very fortunate that I was able to be one of the many people and all who, you know, was considered a friend of, a sister of this great brother and all by the name of Sundiata Sadiq. I met him and all as Walter Brooks and all in Poughkeepsie. And I was coming there, I was doing a speaking engagement for Mumia, and that's when I met him and his wife, who died of cancer, and some years ago, and his first wife. And then been fortunate enough to, and be in the presence of him and Sister Deborah, and you know, his mate, you know, to the very end. And this was a very proud, good brother, and I just can't say how much we'll miss him. And there's so many great things that we can talk about. I got pictures of him at different places and things that we've done together. Like I said, you know, there's no sadness here. And there's only a joy that I was one of the many people and who was blessed enough to be in the presence of him. And my husband, Razakhan Shaheed, he feels the same. And, you know, he was getting ready to leave town. He was going somewhere else. And when he found out about it and changed his whole plans around, and, you know, we came up, and, you know, to pay tribute, and to Brother Sadiq at his janaza.
You know, I know he's smiling somewhere when I say this, but I would love to foil for the files they have on him, because, you know, with the record he left behind, there's a lot of pictures there and a lot of film and a lot of footage.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. You know, they have a lot of pictures, and, you know, the files have to be extensive and all, because he was most definitely a doer.
Yes, ma'am.
And that was somebody that they would want to have records of, and whomever he was around.
And as you were saying, basically, he could handle the spotlight as well as anybody, but he never sought it. He would just as soon be out doing the work. And when he was in front of the cameras, he was doing the work, but he was mostly doing the work that doesn't get rewarded.
That's right. And when he was exposing what Hazel Dukes did, he wasn't exposing for himself. He was exposing for all those, you know, who believed in the thing that, you know, if you was a member and you was doing the right thing, and because even when they fired him, when she fired him, and like I said, it didn't deter him, and he was going in as the NAACP in the beginning, and then he was Brother Sadiq,
right.
Sundiata Sadiq, who was going in, and him and Sister Suzanne Ross, they would go in, and the inmates inside the prison, and the work that they did, they didn't just go in, the work that they did with the brothers inside them prisons, it's just phenomenal, the changes that they made, they escaped me now, but if you talk with Dr. Suzanne Ross, I know she can tell you about the amazing things that had changed inside that prison, they were supposed to go in for Black History Month, of course, he didn't make it this month, but I'm going to suggest that they do a tribute to the work that he did, for the inmates. Because I'm telling you, when they came, the room, the auditorium was packed, always, always packed with people who wanted to hear and to know what was going on the inside and what it is that they have done about making changes inside the prison there. And he also had a barbershop.
That's right. Long time ago. That's
right. Yes, he did.
Right here
in
Austin, New York. Right here in Austin.
Yeah. And, I wasn't fortunate enough to know him, and dealing with the barbershop. But can you imagine Brother Sadiq in a barbershop and people coming in and the talking that goes on and the organizing that went on the inside of that barbershop? Because he was an organizer always.
And also not just the organizing, the education. I was 15 years old when I first met him, and look at what happened to me.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Okay, Pam Africa, thank you for your time. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Want to move.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.